The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're @NewsTalkScience, and we get to your comments this week, next week, at the end of the podcast. Coming up on this week's episode, how fast is gravity? It seems like a stupid question, but not only does it actually have an answer, but the journey to that answer is fascinating and spans more than three centuries. We'll be chatting with Ethan Siegel in a few minutes' time. But first, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining us via Skype are Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story. And then one day you find 10 years have gone behind you. No one told you when to run. You missed the starting gun. Shane, has to do with a very, 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 very precise clock.
Yeah, so precise, you might wonder, why do they need it? But like every clock, it's a very useful way to measure time. And what we do normally for clocks is we look for things with natural rhythm. So today is the solstice. And so even in ancient times, we could tell that a full year had passed because light was passing through the window box in Newgrange. Similarly, we use the rotation of the earth, which is a constant, to measure a day. But when you go down to shorter periods, like a second, it's very hard to find things that have that natural rhythm. So people use pendulums for a long time. But today we use atomic clocks, and they rely on the vibrations of atoms. Atoms that vibrate at a very steady rate, so they have a very steady frequency. And that's how we define the second. And so all time is measured against it. But there, we can still look to improve things. And so the atomic clocks that have been used up to now are very precise, so precise, in fact, that if one were started at the beginning of the universe, today, over 10 billion years later, it would only have lost a second in time. So that is really precise. Yeah, I know. And I know some of these physicists. They're a great bunch. But they're looking to improve it. And that's what this paper in Nature.
This is an important thing to
it
do.
It is. And I'll tell you why in a moment, right?
Go on.
It really is important. I suppose it's the difference between how do you know someone's run a very fast 100 meter race? You need a very accurate clock. And so if you want to do very accurate science experiments, you need very accurate clocks. And so that's why they have these atomic clocks. And the new one is using something called quantum entanglement. So instead of using a kind of a gas or a cloud of vibrating atoms where they have to kind of average out the vibrations, they entangle them so that they're all vibrating in an identical way. So they're behaving as a single unit. And this is a quirk of quantum mechanics and quantum theory. And this allows the physicists take atomic clocks that one step further. It's an improvement on the accuracy. And crucially, it's an improvement on how the clock can be used. So if you're going to put an atomic clock into an experiment associated perhaps with gravitational waves or something that require huge precision with time, then you can run your experiment more accurately.
These clocks are not something we're going to be putting on our bedside table, but wondering, how do you measure something like that? And what sort of a machine do you need to do that?
Well, what you do is you take an ensemble of atoms. In this case, you're actually using ytterbium atoms, 350 of them in this particular setup, and you put them into what's called an optical trap. So you use lasers to zap away their momentum and until they cool down and until they behave as a single quantum unit. And in that state, they'll vibrate as a coherent unit in a very, very uniform way. And that allows the metronome to kind of, you know, a very accurate ticking for you to set your clock against.
If they haven't had a clock to measure how accurate it was before they invented this, how do they know the clock is accurate?
Because the frequency of the oscillation or the vibration is very, very steady. And the second is defined against that, as opposed to the other way around. Right. So what basically happens is you take this ensemble of atoms, you allow it vibrate for thousands of times, and you say, so X thousand vibrations equals 1 second.
Ruth, our second story has to do with biodegradable plastic. And I don't know how I feel about this boom we're seeing in these so-called compostable, so-called biodegradable plastics in our environment. This is not a great story. Tell me about it.
No, it's not. And I think your skepticism is probably quite well placed. This story is a report that Greenpeace released, and they've been looking at China. And China's often in the news when we talk about plastic, because actually it's a place that we have been sending our plastic to be recycled. And it was only in 2017 that China said, no more, we're not going to accept recycling. But as you say, one of the things that scientists have come up with to help deal with plastic pollution was this idea of biodegradable plastic, you know, which on the face of it seems like a good idea, particularly if it's plant-based. But of course, in reality, the amount of production now, so this is really taking off. And in China, they've developed 36 new factories just in the last couple of years. And these factories alone will mean that biodegradable plastic production will be up to around 5 million tons. So that's like 50,000 swimming pools full of biodegradable plastic every year being produced in China alone. And of course, a lot of that then will be shipped globally. And of course, the issue with the biodegrading is it takes time. So even with these extra enzymes, and we've talked about them on the program before, enzymes that then can maybe biodegrade normal plastic, but also can speed up the biodegradation of biodegradable plastic, that process can take 6 months or a year or even longer. But and of course, it has to happen in particular facilities.
Yeah. I mean, 6 months is not too bad if we're talking about, you know, the scar that plastic leaves on our planet, you know, millions of years is a figure that gets thrown around, or at least, you know, hundreds of thousands of years for standard plastic. 6 months we could deal with, but the problem is that you need to dispose of it in a particular type of facility, and people think, oh, it's biodegradable, I'll just put it in the bin.
Absolutely. And of course you can't. And of course, if you put it in the wrong place, the emissions that come from it, the carbon emissions, are obviously can't be controlled. Whereas in a proper industrial plant, you can potentially capture those emissions. But there is just a point about the speed of production as well. You know, yes, 6 months is better than a sort of an eternity almost in the oceans. But, you know, if this plastic ends up in the ocean, it could be there for much, much longer than that. It's not just going to biodegrade by itself. And the capacity is just not there to do that in time when you see that level of production in somewhere like China, which produces so much plastic. So, I mean, again, this is coming down to reduction and reuse and, you know, reusable containers. And, you know, the idea that a biodegradable piece of plastic is not a single use piece of plastic, in fact, it probably is. And unless you have a clear pathway to recycle it, you should probably treat it like a single use piece of plastic. But of course, you know, the banning of single use plastic, it's actually the banning in China and in the EU that is pushing companies down these routes.
Well, I think we need more designated bins for this sort of material, particularly outside the coffee shops that are selling them, because they think they're doing the right thing. They're selling in a biodegradable cup. It's more expensive for them to do that, but they absorb the cost and they sell their coffee thinking they're doing the right thing, and people take the cup and they put it in an ordinary bin.
I mean, when you look at the amount of man-made stuff on Earth now, and we heard recently that it was, you know, outweighing the amount of biomass that's left. I mean, I think what we need to be looking at is an end-of-life plan for anything we produce. I mean, we can't just keep producing and hoping we'll deal with the problem later. We need that plan built in before we make something, and we need to get a lot more strategic about what we're prepared to make and buy.
Our third story has to do with kangaroos, Shane, and this is a funny one.
Yeah, and it's work from a university in Hong Kong, but with an Irish scientist at the lead, a guy called Alan MacEligot. And he's done work looking at how kangaroos can learn to ask for help from humans, just like dogs can, horses, or indeed goats. And this overturns previous theories that an animal's ability to do this, to communicate with people, to ask for help, has been linked to domestication. What he did was
because kangaroos are typically wild.
Yeah, they are. And even those that are in captivity wouldn't be domesticated. Yeah. You know, it'd be like any other animal in a zoo. They're wild animals, basically. And so of the 50 million kangaroos in Australia, which is an incredible number, like more than twice the population of Australia people, he took 16 of them, and they're all living in captivity. And he did, he repeated some tests with them that had been used on horses and on dogs. So what he does is he shows them where a very tasty treat is, but the treat is out of their reach. They can't get at it. It's locked in something. And what the kangaroos started to do was they started staring at the human or sometimes scratching at them, basically looking for help. And other creatures will do this, but only certain ones. And he said it was remarkable to him that they were able to show such connection with humans and knowing that the human can help, realizing that humans would be able to help them get toward the food.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, very, very surprising.
I suppose I'm surprised that it's surprising. I saw one of the videos and it was just showing a kangaroo just looking at where the food was and then looking back at the person and looking back at the food and looking back at the person, like almost like saying to the human, you know, connect the dots here. But I would have thought that lots of animals would be able to figure that out, but I'm surprised to learn they can't.
Yeah, so he says it's not common to see this. There is a short list of species that'll do it. He reckons that it has to do with the fact that kangaroos are a social creature. And learning is, of course, a social enterprise. So that they must rely on other kangaroo in the wild to help them. And so basically they might think a person that's near them who isn't trying to attack them is another kangaroo, is somebody helpful. And so that's basically the way forward. He says they need to go though and figure out, can other creatures living in the wild that are social do this as well? So more from him.
Our final story, Ruth, is a bit gross, but also fascinating. A story about flies and mushrooms.
Flies and mushrooms, yeah. And now I kind of wish we finished with that nice stories about kangaroo being asking for help, because this is a story about zombie flies. So it's a story about flies and fungus. And there's two types of fungi that scientists in Denmark have characterized. They found them a couple of years ago. They've just been declared a species. And they're both from the species Strongwellsi. And they infect a particular kind of fly. Now, when this fungus infects the fly, it burrows into the fly's abdomen and it creates two huge gaping holes, and it gradually eats away at the inside of the fly, you know, eating up its genitals, its fat reserves and all of its muscle. But what's amazing is that the fly just keeps acting normally. So it goes about its business, it interacts with other flies, and that's why they call it a zombie fly, because it's essentially, you know, almost dead. And all the time, this fungus is shooting out rocket-like spores from these enormous holes in the fly's abdomen, attaching onto the other flies that the fly is interacting with.
Wow.
And I think it's just so incredible. I mean, the spores look like rockets. And I mean, the fly eventually just falls down dead, but it's almost just like a husk by the time it reaches that point. And what's so fascinating here, this is only the second example scientists have ever found of this kind of takeover, keeping the host active by a fungus.
Because it's normally something you associate with a parasite, you know, either a tick or a...
Or a virus. Yeah. I mean, look at the situation we're all in now. But what's so amazing is the fungus seems to be producing some sort of amphetamine-like substance to keep the fly as active as possible and feeling okay. And the other compound that scientists believe is being produced is an antimicrobial compound, because these holes in the fly are enormous. And obviously, if the fly gets a viral or a bacterial infection, it will die. And the fungus wants the fly to stay alive for as long as possible. So they're actually calling this potentially the next frontier in drug discovery, because these are compounds that people haven't seen before. And it's really exciting because it's just the beginning of this journey. And when it was only once, there's another fungus that infects a cicada in a similar way and takes it over. But now that they're starting to see maybe there's a family of these fungi out there. So it's absolutely fascinating, albeit it is a little bit disturbing when you think about it.
Well, no, I mean, it's a good news, not for the fly, obviously, but it's good news for us. And it's a fascinating story. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. I'm amazed that it's a fungus that's doing this, though. We did a story on T. gondii, a parasite that does similar sort of host control in a weird life cycle. We must do another thing on parasitic animals and viruses, because it's an absolutely fascinating world. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, thanks very much. All right, on the way, how fast is gravity? A fascinating question with a fascinating answer in a few minutes' time. Now, we know that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, but Newton thought that maybe gravity could be even faster. But what about gravity? Does it even have a speed? And if so, how fast is it? Well, Dr. Ethan Siegel is an astrophysicist, science communicator, and author. He joins me now. Welcome back to the program, Ethan. How are you?
It's my pleasure to be here. I'm doing excellent. Thanks for having me back on.
Gravity is one of those things that I sort of struggle with. And to be honest, I never even got the basics of until I was much, much older in life. So let's start off with those basics. What is gravity?
This is crazy stuff, right? So if you think about what gravity is, we can think about it as a force, right? And that's what Newton did. He said, you know, oh, you have any two objects anywhere in the universe, and there's going to be a force between them, a gravitational force, this invisible force between them. And it wasn't really until Einstein came along more than 200 years later that we got a different idea of what gravity was, where Einstein said, well, maybe it's not so straightforward as just having this invisible force between two masses. Maybe instead what happens is every form of mass or energy in the universe causes this very fabric of space to curve. And then that curved space tells matter and energy how to move through the universe. These are two very different pictures.
Yeah. Talk to me about Newton. He had some very simple ideas of how the world works. And we always talk about, you know, Newton's ideas on this program as if, you know, like Newton wasn't an extraordinarily incredible scientist and thinker. But Newton's idea of how the world works was slightly simplified to how we understand it now. Can you tell me how he thought of gravity?
Sure. And that I think is an excellent point, by the way. Like what you said is fantastic. Like, we should not diminish what Newton did just because he didn't, you know, solve everything for all time. Like, oh no, like what he did was only so good that it took hundreds and hundreds of years for us to find the tiniest flaw in it. What Newton said is, okay, look at this. You have the sun and you have the earth. What does the sun do? Well, it shines, right? And it sends light from the sun to earth. And we know here on earth that light doesn't move at an infinite speed. It only travels at the speed of light. So when the sun emits light and you're here on earth, how long does it take that light to get to you? It takes a little over 8 minutes, a little more than 8 minutes for that light to get to you.
So how fast is that speed of light then?
That speed of light is 300,000 kilometers per second. It's extremely fast, but it's not infinite speed. It's why if you listen to those old Apollo astronaut recordings, there's a delay between when Houston speaks at mission control and when the astronauts on the moon speak, because it takes a little more, about a second and a quarter for light to make a one-way trip to the moon, and then a little over a second and a quarter for light to come back. From the sun, it's 8 minutes. Now, here's the thing that Newton realized, though. If gravity were a force between the sun and the earth, if it took gravity that same 8 minutes to go from the sun to the earth, then the earth wouldn't be attracted to where the sun is right now. It would be attracted to where the sun was 8 minutes ago.
Ha! So it would be like the earth and the sun would have moved on in that space of 8 minutes. And so the gravity would be, so to speak, reaching out into nothingness.
Yeah, it's a weird picture to have in your head. But it turns out that if you do the math, right, and say like, oh, well, the gravity's hitting me where the sun was rather than where the sun is, it would give the wrong answer for the orbits of the planets. Astronomy was good enough in the 1600s that we already knew that, no, that picture's no good. So Newton instead had this picture of, okay, gravity is instantaneous, and you need, therefore, someone at the sun and someone at Earth. They need to all agree on what their definition of space is, what their definition of time is, that everyone has to have the same universal absolute notion of space and time, and gravity needs to be infinite speed or it doesn't work. That was what Newton said. And as far as Newton knew, he was absolutely correct.
Okay. And so for this conversation, I'm already beyond that. Makes sense to me what Newton had said, but we know now that that's wrong, and of course intuitively we must know that something being instant, traveling space in instantly, that must be wrong, that can't be possible. So where did he go wrong, and how fast is the speed of gravity?
Right. So this is a very subtle effect, right? Basically, if I were to say, okay, let's imagine doing something entirely different. Let's imagine the Earth's going around the sun, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to just magically poof. I'm just going to magically make the sun disappear, like it was just pulled out of space somehow. What would happen? Would we know about it for 8 minutes, or would we immediately go flying off, right? The light's still coming from the sun. It's still hitting us. Would we suddenly go flying off into space as though the sun had stopped pulling on us instantly? Or would it take time? With the sun disappearing, would that signal take longer to reach us, the same amount of time to reach us that the light did?
Oh, right? Man, I have no idea. Because to me, in my mind, light is a physical thing. It's matter. It's a thing that moves from A to B. These photons, these light particles, they move from one place to another. I don't understand what gravity is, so I have no idea how to answer that question. If the sun disappeared, how long would it take for the Earth to figure that out and leave its orbit? I don't know.
So it really did take an Einstein to figure that out. What Einstein did is he had to come up with a whole new picture of gravity, because he went back to the beginning and said, okay, look, someone at the sun and someone at Earth, they don't agree on what space is and what time is, because
what
they
move. What
do
you mean by that?
Well, everything is relative, right? This is the theory of relativity. If you and I are at the same exact place, but you are moving through that space and I'm stationary, you're going to see a different universe than I see. Even right. If we're at the same place, you're going to see someone else's clock running at a different speed than I see their clock running at. You're going to see the distance to someone is different than I see it, because lengths contract and time dilates when you move.
And Newton saw that as saw the universe almost as static in a way, right? Not fully static, but that movement messing with the numbers wasn't part of his calculations. And it's a really good example of how our entire universe is constantly in flux, and that there is no way to measure a single distance without taking into account your own movement as well.
That's right. And this is not something that shows up in Newton's equations, which is, you know, a problem for physics, because when we measured the universe precisely enough in the 1800s, we saw actually this motion does matter. This motion does make a big difference. Unstable particles, they live for longer amounts of time when they move close to the speed of light than the stable ones. And that was the example that Einstein had. You know, he talked about trains, but really we knew about enough particle physics early on that, yeah, these things do move. And so then you come back to gravity.
But before you go on there, I think trains is a really good visual example of how to read, in case people aren't with us. Maybe just give that example of the trains to explain relativity.
Sure. So you can imagine, right, if you're watching a train go by, if you are on a parallel train moving at the same speed of that train, it's going to look like the train is at rest with respect to you. So you're going to see the train, each car on that train will be a specific size. If the train, though, is going very fast and you're at rest, you're stationary and you're watching this train go by, what's going to happen? Well, the train is going to look like it's compressed. Each size of each car that goes by on the train is going to look shorter. And the closer that train moves to the speed of light, the shorter and shorter and shorter it's going to get. And that seems crazy and counterintuitive, but this is a consequence of relativity. It's why different what we call observers, and an observer is just someone at a place and a time who's moving with a certain speed. That's it. Place, time, speed, direction. That's it. Different observers don't agree on what simultaneous is. If you have a watch and I have a watch and you go off at the speed of light and come back, our synchronized watches won't be synced up anymore. You will have moved through space and time differently than me.
It's kind of like I gave a talk to schools last year about perception and how we perceive. And one of the things I said is there is no now. And it kind of reminds me of that, that if I'm looking at you or even looking at the mirror, I'm looking at my past, because you have to allow for the fact that time has passed for that light to go there and back. And so there's no synchronous now, because you are at one point in time and you are hearing my voice unique to you. You're seeing light from different places bounce back unique to you. And so it kind of reminds me of that thing that we have to think of these points, these observers, with a relevance of what comes to them, the light, the sound, the gravity, wherever they are in space.
What's so funny about this is Newton thought about this question for everything, for light, for sound, for all of it, except gravity. Newton didn't really think about that for gravity, because all those things you said are true. And when you look in the mirror, that mirror and you, you exert little gravitational forces on each other. So now we come back to what Einstein was thinking, and he had to come up with an entirely new different picture. He said, okay, instead of things being at a fixed place and emitting, you know, something that travels at an infinitely fast speed to communicate instantly, what if instead you had all of these masses, all these different forms of energy, and what they did was that they took whatever this fabric of the universe is, empty space, whatever it is, and we said space and time make a fabric, and putting a mass or energy in there curves that fabric. Sort of like if you held the bed sheet taut at the four corners and you put a bowling ball in the middle, that bed sheet would sag. If you were a marble zipping along that bed sheet, right, you would just move in a straight line if the bowling ball weren't there. But you put that bowling ball down and that marble's going to curve around where the ball is. That's what Einstein said is a more accurate picture, is to imagine that space is not two-dimensional like a bedsheet, but it's a three-dimensional fabric, and that the presence of matter and energy, it curves it. So then he says, okay, if that's what's going on, if Earth is moving through this curved space around the sun, and then I yoinked the sun out of existence, would the Earth feel it right away? How fast does space uncurve? How fast does space go back to being normal? And the answer in Einstein's theory is, well, it's got to move at the speed of gravity. And he said the speed of gravity should equal the speed of light, but we have to measure it to be sure.
That sounds like something we can do.
It was something that we could only do indirectly until about 5 years ago. So we could measure light from things and say, okay, based on the light we're seeing, we can infer that the speed of gravity can't be less than this number or more than this number. And it was consistent with being the speed of light. But 5 years ago, the first gravitational wave detectors, the LIGO detectors in the United States, they detected a gravitational wave from two merging black holes. And this was revolutionary, because what we could do is, from billions of light years away, these two masses are orbiting each other, spiraling into each other, their orbits are decaying, and that means they are emitting gravitational wave. You said you can imagine sunlight comes out and it's these photons, it's these little packets of energy, they travel through space, they're like waves, they're also like particles, and if you detect them, you see them and you can measure, like, okay, I know it was emitted then, I know it's absorbed now. Same thing for gravitational waves as it is for light. We actually can make detectors where the arms of these interferometers, right, these laser arms that go back and forth in perpendicular directions, they stretch and compress, they expand and contract as the gravitational waves go through them.
And so what do we find? Is the speed of gravity equal to the speed of light?
You know, for the first few gravitational wave detections, the answer was it's consistent with that. But we can't really measure it that good, because all we can measure is, look, we've got two of these detectors on Earth, and they're at different points in space. So if we say, okay, the waves are coming in, they're not going to hit every point on Earth at the same time. There's going to be a tiny difference in like milliseconds between when the waves arrive at the two detectors, because they're at different points in space. And that difference allowed us to say, oh, it's not moving at an infinite speed. It's moving at a finite speed that's consistent with the speed of light. But the real key, the real observation that sealed it, was in 2017. Instead of two black holes merging together, we saw two neutron stars spiral in and merge with each other. And when they did, they emitted an enormous flash of light. And we saw the flash of light, and we also saw the gravitational waves. We saw them at literally the same time, like from when that first gamma ray burst was detected and when those gravitational waves first hit us, that difference was less than 2 seconds. The gravitational waves came first, the light came after. So it's sort of like, you know, you see them spiraling in. And since we're going to be on radio, you know, we say like, oh, when you spiral in, you can make a waveform out of it. So it sounds like a constant sound as these two black holes or two neutron stars orbit each other. But then it gets louder and higher pitched. So it sort of sounds like boop. And then 2 seconds later, you ding, that light comes. These things are 140 million light years away, and the light and the gravitational waves arrived within 2 seconds of each other. That tells us that the speed of gravity is equal to the speed of light to within about one part in a quadrillion, which is a one with 15 zeros after it. So pretty confident now that the speed of gravity and the speed of light are equal to at least 99.99149%.
You know, I hope you stuck with that, because I know it's quite dense sometimes for a Saturday afternoon on this program, but I thought that was absolutely fascinating. Ethan Siegel, who has a book out, by the way, looking at the science of Star Trek, it's called Treknology. He explains science so well, particularly his beloved field of astronomy. Thank you so much for joining us. Really, really enjoyed that.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for keeping us all curious and informed about this.
He has such enthusiasm for the subject, doesn't he, Ethan? All right, it's time for texts and tweets from last week. And you can tell it's Christmas because we have hardly any comments from anyone. But I did get a question from Deirdre, who says, fascinating segment on particles last week. My 7-year-old son is fascinated by it. Any book recommendations for this age group? Well, subatomic physics is a tricky subject, but there is an Osborne flap book, which allows you to see inside atoms and molecules. And I find those books, Osborne do great educational books. And it's sort of, you know, open it up and you can lift inside and stuff. It's a good playful thing. There's 90 flaps on it. It looks pretty good, to be honest. That's what I would suggest. There is another book called Quantum Physics for Smart Kids, but I can't really speak about that because I don't know much about those books, but it seems quite cute. Join Valencia, the little scientist, under Cat Planck as they learn why Planck can never seem to catch the laser he loves to play with. To do this, they must shrink down to the smallest size imaginable. Once they're tiny, they can better learn about quantum physics, discovering secrets that are invisible to those of us who are full-sized. Sounds good, doesn't it? You can get that on Amazon, or better, an Irish bookshop and get them to order it in for you. That's it for us on this week's podcast. Thanks for listening and subscribing, downloading, sharing, letting people know about the show. We really appreciate it. If you can do one thing for us as a Christmas present, is just tell somebody about Future Proof, point them towards our podcast. We'd really appreciate it. Thanks to the production team, Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mulhall, Stephen McClune, and Stephen Daunt. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. But our next full show is the Christmas special. It's the other side of Christmas. So I won't see you. So have a great Christmas, and I will see you on the 26th. Stay curious.